Yeah, it's not very fashionable these days to talk about having visions or to confess to having visions or to being visited by angels, as Blake was. But I have to admit that I have had a few what might be called visions in the past. Quite early on in my life, I remember when I was a child, probably something about 7 or 8, my father had an allotment in Darwin on the moors, not quite on the moors, just below the moors. And I used to go there and play quite a bit. We had an apple tree that I used to build spaceships underneath. And one day I remember this very, very vividly. There was a pail of a kind of can of water, like quite a big one, several gallons, maybe 5 gallon can. Just by the shed, the garden shed. And I remember it was a bright sunny day, very unusually. And I remember looking down into this canister of water and seeing another world down there, a blue sky and clouds. And I thought that there really was a world down there under the ground, you know, which had its own sky and its own people, perhaps. At that age, it's a reality. One really believes in these things. They're not just ideas or metaphors. And that stayed with me for years, that idea that there's another world below this one. And of course, there is, isn't there? But I regard these things, maybe visions is too pompous a word, but I like the word showings that Padmavajra used yesterday, showings. I forget the actual technical term that he used for them, but I just like the idea that something is being shown to us. Of course, you could say it implies the gods or givings, teachings, and all that, depending on which culture you belong to. You may or may not use that language. But I increasingly have begun to use that language of visions. And they've happened throughout my life, but in very, very very, very low-key ways, ways we should hardly recognize them, you know. And it's happened hundreds of times. And one of the most recent times it's happened was when I was doing a solitary retreat in Herefordshire, actually at Vidya Devi's house, where they have a lovely garden, lots of land and orchards. And one night, it was in summer, quite late, around 11 o'clock, I just went out into the garden and stood looking up at the sky, and it was a completely clear night, and all the stars were out there, and I just stood. I had no idea how long I stood there, because I wanted to experience the stars out of a city. And the longer I stood there, the more absorbed I became in this apparition, this celestial apparition. And I just stood gazing up at it. And as I did that, it appeared, and it certainly felt like, the stars came down and just stood around me on the earth, or in the sky just above the ground. And they were all around me and underneath me. And they were kind of beings. Each one had an individual reality, an individual almost character. And I regard that, I've no idea how long that went on. I just had an increasing sense of living in a sacred universe and a sacred earth. In fact, there was nothing that was not sacred. Everything was connected. And that has stayed with me right up to now, right up to this moment. You could, depending again on which culture you belong to, talk about them as angels or as devas or as many other kinds of beings different traditions have used. But I don't think it's important what language you use. It's the experience of sacredness that matters. And gradually, as I've got older, the sense of connectedness has grown in me. And this is where, obviously, the Dharma and writing come in, because writing is a way of witnessing that connectedness. And I have to say that I'm not very keen on the language of intensity. I don't use it, and it makes me feel uncomfortable, because I associate it with forcing myself to do meditation practice when I was first ordained and before it, without any sense of this sacredness, without any sense at all of this connectedness. And it became a task which I was constantly failing at. So I just dropped the whole idea of coercion and creating this sense of obligation that you have to do this, otherwise you're just a no-good Buddhist, really. So I remain uncomfortable with that language, and I much prefer the approach of allowing the gods in the form of the universe to come down and talk to you and show themselves. And what we are doing in spiritual practice is creating the conditions in which the gods can do that, or the stars, or the cosmos can do that. Because I've come fairly recently, in the last 5 years, to realize that the universe is a spiritual path. It's not that there is a path that which we find through the teachers. The universe, and I mean the cosmos and everything in it, is nothing but a spiritual path. It's in every atom. Spirituality is in every atom. And, you know, there was some talk recently, a few years ago, about the God particle. Some people associated that with the Higgs boson. That story has been rather thrown out recently, because the person who originally talked about the God particle confessed that what he had originally said was that goddamned particle. So that rather undermines the basis of that. That may be apocryphal, I suppose, but I like it all the same. So in the next 5 minutes, I hope I've still got 5 minutes, I'm just going to list, because every Dharma talk has to have a list, doesn't it? And the tradition is that lists have got 10 items, yeah? So I've got a list of 10 items. And this list is emerging, or has emerged, out of this experience. It's not the other way around. It's not that I practice and then the experience came as a result of the practice. My experience is, what I felt was that I realized that the universe is how I've described, like a sacred path, sacred being. And it's all connected intimately on every level, from quarks to galaxies. And so this list of how my life has changed as I've come to realize this is the result of that vision. So the first one is clarify what's really important. And this has the effect, as I'm sure you know, that you gradually withdraw energy from what isn't important, which gives you a lot more freedom to practice. So clarify what's really important for you at that stage of your life. Secondly, simplify. Simplify lifestyle. Declutter, in the modern jargon. And then declutter the clutter that's left. Cut out unnecessary meetings, which means really cutting out all meetings. Because if you allow some meetings to stay, they'll gradually expand and create little sibling meetings. So you really have to go the whole hog and cut them all out, really. Thirdly, stop putting things off. I'm a terrible procrastinator. I hate doing things until they absolutely have to be done. Several people who know me will attest. So one of the things that made me realize this was Manjushra's death, of course, which was very, very traumatic for me as well as a lot of other people. But it did not force me to make my will. Even then, after that, I realized it took me 2 years to get around to making my will. And thank God I've done it now, but I put that off, even such a thing as under the impulse of someone, a very close friend's death. I didn't really get the message for 2 years. Because it means facing certain things you don't want to face. Like, A, you're going to die. Fourth, connected with that, is attend to health problems. I've always putting off things dealing with my health, and I've had a few health problems in the last couple of years, which has forced me to sort of do something about it. If you don't do that, if you keep putting them off, you start worrying about it, and it takes up a lot of your energy. And I didn't, you know, I needed that energy, so I wanted to get these things sorted out while I still could. Five, identify the most unconscious or automatic actions and bring awareness into them, which is fairly standard practice, isn't it? One of my things was I had to spend a lot of time before I meditated or wrote in the morning, I had to spend a lot of time clearing up the room and getting rid of all my papers. And that tended to take all the time up. So there was no time left at all for meditation or writing. That was a very bad habit. Use every moment to reassess the congruity of your behaviour with your ideals. I think it's fairly self-explanatory. And for me, writing first thing in the morning, the very first thing, before anything else gets in the way of it, I do some writing. Could be 5 minutes, could be 2 minutes even, but you have to do some as a very beginning, just to tell the gods or to tell the universe that you're serious about this. It's a meaningful thing. You're not just filling in the time before you die. Thank you. Three more very quick ones. Eliminate the idea that I have to have perfect conditions, because I will never have perfect conditions. Think I need perfect conditions, I will never practice, so I will never change, so I will never get what I want, which is happiness. 9, observe how my mind is always slipping away into the past or the future. And believe me, it does. 99 times out of 100, it does. It's not in the present. You know, I'm worrying about the past or planning the future. And since neither of those exist, it's a rather pathetic exercise, really. And finally, remember, there is no guarantee whatever that I will be alive in even 5 minutes' time. So do it now. Thank you very much.